But I was just talking about this video that I had seen once, and it was, I don't know if we could call it amateur, but it was a home video of sorts, probably from professional divers making an amateur TV show out of it. I don't know. Anyway, it wasn't the best video, but they tastefully edited it. But you could see that there was still a person inside. It seemed like there was still a body, a very ghostly image of somebody that was stuck for eternity in the cabin of the Edmund Fitzgerald. And it was because of the temperature of the water that the body was preserved the way that it was. And as our guest, Dr. Lee Spence, said, this is not uncommon. Under certain conditions, he doesn't run into it very often, but the government will use that excuse all the time that, hey, this is a grave site, and so this is not to be disturbed. And that's just where I want to pick up the conversation next. I mean, there are grave sites, right? I mean, that we should know that and recognize that. And as he said, certain battleships and other things where there are actual people involved that will never be retrieved, that's one thing. But when they use it as leverage on people who are treasure hunting or historians or archaeologists, well, what can one do to fight the government? And for that matter, is this just a matter that the government wants you to do all the work where it collects all the benefit? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Dr. Lee Spence, we were just talking about the recovery of certain artifacts or the exploration of ships on the bottom of the ocean that the government tries to put the kibosh on under the basis that it's an underwater grave, even though there are no bodies on it. The ship went down, but anybody else would have gotten off while it was still topside when people are still trying to get into lifeboats or whatever. How often does the government use that excuse? Well, first of all, what branch of the government tells you what you can and can't explore?
The part of the government that I sort of fear the most is the state government. And
Okay.
so we avoid working in state waters, and we work outside of state waters where they don't have any control. We're out in U.S. territorial waters working. State waters extend 3 nautical miles, and we're working about 4 or 5 miles offshore. There's a shoal out where we're working, and a number of ships hit over the years wrecked there. And so we have sort of a cluster of ships that we've been working.
Okay. But I want to go more general because I read an interesting blog on your website about a time when you encountered, was it North Carolina or the South Carolina government? It's under the blog title about ghost wrecks, ghost galleons, both real and imagined. And so I think most people, when they think about treasure hunting, they think how complicated it is to actually recover the money, because as soon as you find something, the government will swoop in and go, hey, wait, that's ours. Or insurance companies, or somebody else will, or somebody who owns the rights to that ship because the company was bought 3 times since that ship went down, but there's still a viable corporation that owns the rights to that ship or something. So how do you negotiate the legal waters around a shipwreck?
Well, on the wrecks that we're working right now, I filed a claim in U.S. District Court claiming ownership on the basis that I was the discoverer of lost and abandoned property. And I also, at the same time, I was claiming rights as salver. And salvage is a different law from the law of fines. And anyway, the court ended up ruling that I was the legal owner of the wreckage, that I was the exclusive legal owner. And so once they did that, no one else could come in afterwards. They had their opportunity while I was in court to make a claim, and they failed to make it. And so no one can now come and claim it. The ones
But
that you read about, they were challenged while it was still in court.
But wait, I want to make sure I understand that. So once you have the official claim, the title to a wreck, does that give you exclusive salvage rights to that wreck?
Well, I'm the owner of the wreck, and I'm also salvage in possession. They're my wreck. So what salvage is, if somebody goes and they start working a wreck and they want to be paid for their services, just like somebody who works on your house and files a worker's lien. And so salvage is more like a worker's lien against it. But somebody can't just come and work on your house without your permission. And if someone else is already working on it, they're probably not going to give you permission. Well, I'm working on my wreck. I'm salvage in possession, and I'm not going to give anyone else the right to work on my shipwrecks. But I'm the owner of them on the bottom,
so
and
let's
I'm
say,
actively pursuing them.
So let's say you discovered a chest full of rubies, and it's worth, you know, $20 million. And that is on your wreck that you own, that you salvaged with your rights after having been recognized as the legal owner of that wreck. Is that the end of the story? They're just your rubies. You get to haul them up and you get to do whatever you want to do with them and nobody can do anything about it?
Basically, you're correct on that. They would be your rubies. And, yeah, the government couldn't take them. The state or the federal government could not take them. And insurance could not take them. If you had fudged on it, if you had lied in your court filing, then they might be able to. And that's sort of what happened on one company where they claimed they did not know what the ship was that they were working, and yet they had gone after that particular ship and had every reason to know exactly what it was. And so they had gone into the court, and this is sort of theoretical, this is sort of my opinion, but they... My opinion is they went into the court and misrepresented the case. And so they lost it to Spain. I don't think they would have lost that wreck to Spain if they had been honest with the court right from the very beginning. And I'm using the term honest sort of loosely because I'm sure they feel they were being honest in that they had not technically identified it. They didn't find the ship's number. There weren't any at that time. They didn't find something with the ship's name on it, but they didn't even give a clue to the court that it might be that particular wreck. And yet they had abundant historical research and archaeological artifacts on all that they had found that told them that's what it was.
Well, I want to go back to the Ghost Galleons piece that you wrote, because I find that fascinating. But let me move a little bit sideways here. Let's say it's back to the conversation we were having about that ship 2109 that is 150 miles off the coast of Florida. It's in the middle of the Gulf. Can anybody make a claim on that? Or since it was discovered by NOAA when they were doing a test on a submersible, it's a government thing because they were the one that found it? Or is it just the first person to get to the courts to be able to say, I want to salvage that ship?
Well, actually, that is the case. NOAA could find the thing, and then another group could come in and dive it and bring up artifacts from it, and they could go into federal court, and they could claim it. NOAA might then say, hey, you used our information. We were first in line or whatever, and you would have a court fight over it, but they would have a legal argument that they should get it because they filed it first. But on that wreck, if it is the official number on it, if that number 2109 is the ship's official number, the heirs to whoever owned it back then would have a legal claim. Or the insurance company that insured it would have a legal
right.
claim. And it probably was insured.
Right.
Most of the ships were. But you would have to prove, the insurance company would have to prove that it did pay off on the insurance.
Right.
The heirs would have to show that, hey, I can trace it right back. But they could go into court and claim that if someone else went and filed an admiralty claim, they could come in as an intervening claimant.
Yeah, and they and again, if nothing else, you get a percentage. I mean, they might negotiate something where they say, okay, you get 20%, and I'll withdraw my claim, but you know, you cut me in, and everybody settles it out of court that way, right?
Well, normally that would be the way. Part of it, if you you go and you find something like that. The percentage that goes to the owners back then would normally be very small. In a worst-case scenario, it ought to be 50%. In a normal thing, it would probably be 10. Okay. And you could often get a settlement for 1 or 2%.
If there's so much
I'm
gold...
I'm talking about the owners getting 1 or 2%.
Right, right. If there's so much gold float, why doesn't the government have its own treasure hunting department using
called
government?
The CIA.
But seriously, I mean, they've got the satellite technology, they've got the Navy, they've got merchant marines, they've got the Coast Guard. I mean, why isn't there some division somewhere where there aren't? They're the ones diving for these wrecks just to throw the money into the, you know, into the general coffers of the United States.
Well, I got a call one day from somebody in intelligence at the Pentagon, and they were wanting to know if I would work with them. And anyway, what he was proposing, they were finding a lot of shipwrecks. And they didn't know what the wrecks were, and they were hoping that I could identify them, and I say they, a small group of men,
right.
Not the government itself. And what they were doing was using the government information they had access to, and they were going to try to cut themselves in for a share. I don't know if it was legal on their part or not, but I was actually interested in doing something with them. So one morning... Well, I'd gone up to Washington. I stayed in Arlington, and my wife was driving me to the Pentagon to drop me off to meet with this man. And suddenly there were sirens and everything else. The towers, the Twin Towers had been attacked in New York.
Wow.
And the Pentagon was hit. And
so,
I never
yeah.
heard from that man again.
Oh, my gosh.
I was not able to ever reach him. I don't know if he was one of the ones that died or what.
Wow. Wow. That's very interesting.
But I was literally on the way to the Pentagon when it was hit.
When 9/11 happened.
Yeah.
That's a historic day for many reasons, then all layered on top of each other. So, I enjoyed this this blog you wrote called Ghost Galleons, Both Real and Imagined. The story of the Flying Dutchman is the first, you know, I think, ghost galleon that comes to mind. But there are lots of people who report ghost ships. And I believe I've done a show or two on an author of maritime history that has tracked some of these over the years. Where are you on the whole ghost ship phenomenon?
Well, it's easy to see where the stories came from. You could have sailing ships that they would get into a storm and people would be washed overboard or drowned. In some of these storms, they were so bad that people would tie themselves where they were at the helm so they wouldn't be washed overboard. And then after the storm, everybody's dead on the ship. You know, they've all drowned or been hurt, you know, with collapsed
right.
masts or whatever. And the ship is still afloat. It doesn't sink. And so there would be reports back in the 17 and 1800s where other ships would see these vessels. When they could, they would actually board them and see what cargo was there, find out the names, the name of the ship, who the people were, and they would report it. But other times, it'd be too rough and they couldn't board it. And they would talk about seeing men tied in the rigging because they would have to go up in the rigging to work the sails during the storm, but they were afraid of being, with the rocking of the ship, that they would be thrown overboard and they would tie themselves in the rigging. And so there would be skeletons up in the rigging. There would be skeletons, a skeleton at the wheel. And these ships would actually drift for 1,000 miles or more. And in the late 1800s, the U.S. government actually tracked the course of floating ships, and they published a map every year showing the course that these floating derelicts were taking. I think they stopped doing that in the 1940s or maybe just before the World War II, I'm not sure. But those maps exist, and some of those ships ended up running ashore on land eventually. But yeah, those are the real ghost ships.
Yeah, they are. And then around them, of course, then as you're intoning these, you know, these legends are built as people have seen them. And the Flying Dutchman is one of those great legends that, and it was also seen as sort of a, if I remember correctly, sort of a portend of disaster, that if you ran into the, if you got, you know, as men of the sea tend to be very superstitious, that if you had seen the Flying Dutchman or the Flying Dutchman crossed your path, you were being beckoned to doom of some sort, which of course is fascinating, but has just as much to do with our own imaginations. And I could see where those would be the real ones. But there's got to be the same sort of thing for treasures, and they sort of like ghost treasures that people talk about, that people are going after, that don't ever actually exist. Legends that have been built on legends, but there's no truth behind them in the end.
Well, there was a wreck back in the late 1700s in New York Harbor. It seems like it was actually during the American Revolution. I'm not sure about that. It seems like it was 1777. A British ship called the Hussar. And the story arose that it had a bunch of gold on it, and there have been numerous expeditions back in the 20 years after it wrecked, 30 years after it wrecked, 50 years after it wrecked, people looking for that ship and trying to salvage the gold off of it. But the captain of the ship survived. In fact, I believe everybody survived. And there was a court-martial afterwards, a court of inquiry, to try to see what actually happened with the ship. In the court of inquiry, there's not a single mention of any money being lost. And if the government was saying, hey, you lost the payroll, well, if you lost the big payroll, which is supposedly what the gold was,
right?
I think in the court of inquiry, they would ask him, what happened to the gold? But they did not ask that. And so I don't believe any gold is on that ship.
But it still inspires other people to keep looking for it.
Yes. Clive Cussler was looking for it at one point.
Right. Yeah. That's right. And he was the guy who was one of the earliest, I thought, of the, in, you know, again, speculative fiction, but Raise the Titanic was an exciting book, because of the way in which it took seriously the notion of being able to raise a ship from the bottom of the ocean. Since then, of course, it's been done a few times, but I don't think a ship on any of that scale could ever be brought up. But I'll ask our guest, Dr. Lee Spence, on that in just a second. And I want to ask him, since he spent all this time underwater, diving on these, you know, mysteries and trying to solve the origin of these shipwrecks, what is the most extraordinary thing he's ever seen underwater? And I'll give you a context for that question coming up in just a moment too, but then we'll get to your calls too for Dr. Lee Spence on the way on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. We're going to crack open the phones coming up at the top of the hour. We'll give you all the numbers you need on the way, but not quite yet. And I want to pick at this one idea. How much time has Dr. Lee spent underwater going around these mystery wrecks trying to determine their origin? Or just even that, just as somebody who's been trying to figure out stories, even, topside, just like what exactly, how far back he can he trace these stories? I'm just curious, what's the most extraordinary thing he's come across yet? We talked about the Hunley earlier, which was an early find of his, and then also very likely the real Rhett Butler type, the archetype perhaps for the Rhett Butler character in Gone with the Wind, a guy who was a blockade runner, who he was able to identify. But I'm just curious, for a guy with these kind of unique experiences, I'm sure he's got some cool stories to tell next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. You can link up to Dr. Lee Spence and his full bio at coasttocoastam.com. You can also click on to me at Twitter there if you want to, and follow me at Deacon Punnett. So I am curious about these things which you have experienced. You obviously have a, for, in terms of like the coolest person at the party with stories, you've got to be like up there in the top 1% of every party you ever go to. When somebody brings up anything, you're gonna have like some other story that'd be totally topping that. But what are some of the most extraordinary things you've seen along your travels?
Well, when you find gold underwater, it looks brand new. It looks totally out of place on the bottom. And so that's probably the most spectacular thing that you'll find, whether it's gold rings or gold coins or gold sword handles or whatever. It's absolutely beautiful.
And
But to me,
it glistens to you as a diver. I mean, you actually see it as you're approaching it.
oh, it's, well, you'll be fanning the sand, and as you fan the sand away, suddenly the coins start appearing, and
Wow.
they look brand new. They're still shiny. Whereas silver will turn black, will get corroded, get all encrusted. It's real rare to see any incrustation at all on gold. We have found coins that will have coral on them or stains, gold ones, but most of the time they're absolutely perfect.
Oh, that was so
And
freaky.
it really is amazing to see it.
Yeah. And you said sword handles too. So I'm assuming from that that's something that's come up a few times.
A few times, yes.
Armaments in general? I mean, guns, do you run across, that like the typical
I
stuff that.
found cases of guns, cases of muskets on the bottom, where they're still packed in the cases. And you were talking about what's the most spectacular. Part of what flashed to my mind was when we were finding the cases of champagne and scotch on the wreck of the Regina in Lake Huron. And we were bringing up G.H. Mumms and Veuve Clicquot, Dewar Scotch, White Mackay Scotch, and all, but by the case. And that was amazing. And when we're bringing up the champagne, sometimes the corks would start popping out of the bottles because
Right.
the little wires holding them on had rusted away.
Right.
And those we had to drink on the spot.
You had to. You just had to.
Yeah.
Now,
Yeah, we did not want it lost.
and does it really work? I mean, so the scotch, the champagne, anything coming up from the bottom, assuming that the seal hasn't been broken, it tastes just like it would have, as it's supposed to taste?
No, it doesn't. It was the best champagne I've ever had. I'd never even liked scotch before. What we have is a lot better.
What we have today is better, or what you pulled off the bottom of the ocean
What
was
we
better?
pulled off the wreck was spectacular.
Was it? I bet.
Yeah.
And what an interesting aging process.
Yes, very slow aging.
Yeah.
Because it's cold, and the corks, for some reason, never dried out when they were down there.
I wonder why they haven't turned that into a thing where they just like submerge
They're
scotch.
actually doing that now. There's a company in Charleston that's doing that, and they're
Really?
putting some down in the harbor. And it because the water temperatures really do affect how it ages,
Huh.
and So that is something they're doing.
I love that. Harbor aged.
Yeah.
That's very
Set
cool.
up in a cave or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Though one of the things that I like about the company Galleon Quest is that they realize that it's not just the gold and silver down there that's valuable, but the cargoes. For instance, when I found the Georgiana, I was actually in high school when I found the Georgiana. I'm now 71. And the
Right.
Georgiana wasn't my first shipwreck, but it was the first one that was just absolutely loaded. It had 400 tons of cargo on it. And when that cargo was purchased, it cost $1 million. So you
Wow.
can imagine after 100 years
Sure.
what a cargo like that is worth. But no, I like Galleon Quest because they're not just interested in the gold. They see there is not only historical value, but monetary value in the other cargoes as well.
How much
But
did
we
you make
called
as it?
over
Go ahead.
when off of the Georgiana, we actually pulled up over 1 million shirt buttons. We brought up millions of brass straight pins off of the wreck. We
Wow.
brought up cases of musket balls. We brought up cases of cannonballs, not the round ones, but the conical projectiles. We just found, well, there were cases of china. We were unpacking barrels on the bottom and bringing up bottles, you name it. It was all sorts of stuff. We found opium on the wreck.
That wasn't hadn't dissolved into water.
It was in bottles.
Wow. What, who
And
got that? Who would get that? Who'd you have to turn that over to?
well, back then, we weren't even thinking of it that way.
Yeah.
It was just artifacts to us. But you know the movie, I'm trying to think of the name of it, but the one where there was a Spanish galleon underneath a more modern wreck. And on the modern wreck, they were finding the morphine, and the earlier wreck had treasure on it. Well, the Georgiana, there's another ship sitting on top of it, and that's the Mary Bowers. The Mary Bowers crashed through the wreck. The Georgiana had run aground, and then later, the Mary Bowers ran right through it and sits on top. Another ship called the Constance, it hit those wrecks and it got off a few hundred yards and it sank. And then there was another ship that hit it and went inshore and sank. That's how cluttered it is out there.
Yeah, no, I totally get that. But so I want to go back to that question though. But like, so you find the opium, and there's nobody. This is when you were in high school, and so you just took the opium that was in the glass jar and did what?
We sold the bottles and everything with the contents in them.
Wow. How much did you make? How much as a teenager did you make off that wreck?
Well, if I was doing it today, that one wreck would have easily been $50 million worth of stuff. But no, I made money off of it. But yeah, I was able to buy equipment and have a lot of fun for a number of years pursuing other wrecks and all. But
Right.
I didn't make what I should have off of it, but I did make a lot of money.
And that was owing to the fact that what, you were a teenager? Did other people come along and take advantage of you, or that it just
Well, that
wasn't?
was part of it. It was a growing experience. But actually, what I was making from the Georgiana while I was doing it would have put me in the top 1% of the country for income at that time. And I was a teenager.
I love that. I totally love that. So I have to ask this question because I think this would be the first thing my wife would think of, not me, but this would be the first thing is sharks, sea snakes, other underwater predators. How often does that come up when you're diving a wreck?
Well, there are no sea snakes in the Atlantic or the Caribbean, so we don't have to worry about them.
Got it.
As far as sharks, most of the time we're working in zero visibility because we're working in areas where there's a lot of energy, where the waves are crashing and all, and that's what caused the wreck. And so we don't see the sharks. They're there, but we don't see them. When we're out, like where we're doing at Cape Romaine on those wrecks, the water is fairly clear at times. And when it's nice and clear, we see them. And they're some can be real big, but they don't bother us.
They're not protecting the wreck, as legend goes. You know, sharks swimming around to protect.
They're eating the fish there.
Yeah.
That's why they're there on the wreck. I think they looked at them as feeding stations because there are lots and lots of fish on the shipwreck.
Do you have to have one person in your crew being mindful of that sort of thing, or does everybody just kind of get along enough to not have to have a watchman?
I honestly don't even worry about the sharks. They're not going to eat me. If I'm on the surface swimming, then I worry about it because then I'm sort of like a dying fish up on the surface, and I'm afraid the sharks will mistake me for something.
Right.
But when I'm down with them, I don't look like lunch.
Right. You know, I saw sea snake. I didn't know that they weren't on the Atlantic side, but I was with my family down vacationing off of Mexico, and sea snake came right up to the little skiff that we were all in. That were sightseeing skiff, and that was the person who was hosting it, who was on the microphone, was saying, "Wow, if you look off to the right here, this is a rare thing. You'll see a sea snake, and it's right on the surface of the water. They're very poisonous, so let's make sure you keep your hands in." And the sea, and it came, and it like charged our boat, it, like came right up to the boat, like it scared the hell out of all of us because we knew how powerful that venom actually is, and how far out we were, and how it would have been just a race to get back to the coast in time. So, this life that you have led is pretty extraordinary, and that as a marine archaeologist and as an author and as somebody who's now involved in all sorts of historical salvage, what has been the most satisfying of all of the wrecks that you have found that you helped either bring to the surface or bring to the attention of mainstream culture or historians? Which one's the most satisfying after all these years?
Well, I'm sort of torn between the Georgiana, which I did so many years ago, and what we're doing right now.
Tell me about more about right now.
I found, in my research, I'd come across reference after reference where ships were lost out at Cape Romaine. And so I started focusing on it and started researching. And then the first time I went to Cape Romaine, I went out to the shoal, and this shoal is like 4.5 miles offshore. At the shallow end of the shoal, it's only 3 feet of water at low tide. And you go from 20-something feet to 3 feet in a very shallow, in a very short distance. Or if you're coming from another direction, you have about 40 feet of water, and suddenly you're up in 10 feet of water at that spot. And so it's a death trap. And if a ship wrecks out there, let's say that it's a Spanish galleon. And most people don't realize it, but the Spanish galleons sailed right up past Charleston every year for almost 300 years. And so anyway, the galleons would try to stay several miles offshore because the water off South Carolina, which was then called Florida, Florida went all the way up to Virginia. It went from Virginia to Mexico with Florida. I love working there because we're working on so many different types of shipwrecks. We found a couple of steamers out there. One had been heavily involved in smuggling. Another was carrying merchandise and all. Then we've got that 1790s wreck. We've got the Rhett Butler wreck, and we're working all those. So to me, it's extremely exciting.
But I want to go back to that galleon thing because you mentioned it, and I'm afraid I may have made you lose your train of thought. So those galleons that were going up and down the coast off Charleston, they were staying a couple miles out because of tricky waters. But what would then typically happen in that death trap? You had just started to tell us more about that. So the galleons would get caught in
So part of why I was attracted to that location was knowing that the galleons would come up the coast every year. And one of the very first shipwrecks that happened, we're talking about a wreck. Well, the first wreck at Cape Romaine was in the 1520s. It was a Spanish shipwreck. Then in the 1550s, there was a fleet that was lost on the coast of Florida. And when they came to look for it, the first spot they went to, because they knew how dangerous it was, the very first spot they went to was Cape Romaine, but the fleet was not there. It was on another part of Florida, what's now called Padre Island, Texas.
What?
Yeah. That's how big Florida was.
Yeah, really? So all the way around on the other side, that's where it was.
Exactly, yes.
Wow. So these galleons typically, I mean, that's the kind of thing that we hear about. I mean, somebody says galleons and it just, we think of the, right away, that's where most of the treasure was, and the pirates would have been coming after those Spanish ships off the coast of Charleston, the pirates that worked in and out of the coves along the, what was then the Florida coast, I guess, but they would come out after they would make a run at those ships, the slower, bigger ships as they went past. Is that the kind of thing we're talking about, that they were actually filled with, if you pardon me saying it, gold doubloons?
Well, their cargoes, they were actually carrying back tons of silver back then. They were not finding a lot of gold in the New World. They were finding gold, but it amounted to just a small percent of the total cargo. Most of what they were mining and bringing back in coin form, because they actually set up mints in the New World, most of that was silver. So you might have literally 40 tons of silver on a wreck, and then you might have 250 pounds of gold. It was that significant of a difference.
Well, help me do the math. What is 40 tons of silver on a ship that you find now worth?
It could be worth $500 million.
Whoa, on one ship.
That's what Mel Fisher found on the Atosha. He found 40 tons of silver and bars and coins, and I think he found a couple hundred pounds of gold.
And that's then what's still driving you in this group, Galleon Quest?
Yes, that is part of it. I'm driven by the history and the archaeology, the thrill of discovery. I like making money, but I look at the money as sort of a sideline. It's just a benefit of being able to do what I want to do. But yes, companies like Galleon Quest, they're out there to make money. They would not be investing in what I'm doing if they did not believe I was going to bring up enough to make it worthwhile.
How much would it cost typically then to salvage a wreck? What are the capital expenses from a company like that for you to in both the research and the discovery phase?
It's real hard to put a number on the research, because sometimes when you're doing research, it takes years. I had actually started researching the Georgiana when I was 12 years old, and I found it when I was in high school. I found my first shipwrecks when I was 12, but the Georgiana was my senior year of high school.
I had a job delivering for a drugstore, and I sold records at a local head shop. That's what I did my senior year. All right, well, hang on to this. We'll get to all the phones. We'll give you the numbers. Shipwrecks, The Mysteries of the Deep. Dr. Lee Spence takes your calls, and we'll have a great hour ahead on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.